Oh, first of all, Ennio Morricone. We are honored that Maestro Morricone founded this place in the late of 60s, in 1969 exactly. And so after that, he recorded in this place all his masterpieces, including Once Upon a Time in America and La Leggenda del Pianista sull'Oceano, I don't know the English title, sorry, and Nuovo Cinema Paradiso. So actually Ennio Morricone is one of the biggest name, together with Nicola Piovani, also Oscar Prize for Life is Beautiful, we're recorded here.
The voice of Marco Patrignani there from Rome's Forum Studios. More from him a little later. Coming to you from the Cinecittà Film Studios in Rome, this is a special edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Ahead today.
The Great Beauty is a profoundly Italian film rooted in Italy. This Must Be the Place is a film I have at heart, and it is rooted in certain music videos that are not Italian.
Italy's master of the cinema, Paolo Sorrentino, on how he brought his vision of Rome to the screen. Meanwhile, in Australia.
Because it's love. I mean, everyone relates to love. I hope everyone relates to love. I mean, the fact that it's gay is a hugely important part of it.
As the country's political struggle with same-sex marriage continues, we'll look at a new Australian film in theatres today, adapted from one of the most respected books in the nation's literary history. All that, plus a guided tour of the Cinecittà backlot. That's on this special edition of The Cinema Show in Rome on Monocle 24. Hello from a place many consider the beating heart of European cinema, Rome's famous Cinecittà Film Studios. I'm Ben Rylan. This is a place with an interesting history. It could have become a shunned symbol of the country's difficulties under the fascist rule of Mussolini. Instead, Italians have made the studio facility their own, and there's scarcely a European legend who hasn't passed through the gates. Our guide for today is Elena Scipioni. Let's start the tour.
Cinecittà opened in 1937 thanks to Benito Mussolini, who well understood that image was a very important vehicle of propaganda. Together with the Istituto Luce, that used to produce newsreels that were screened at cinema before the movie, and the Centro Sperimentale di Cinematografia, they were composing, they were forming here a sort of cinema district, quite exactly in the middle between the center of Rome and Castelli Romani. Castelli Romani are those hills that you can see when you go out and look on your left. It was a strategic place, it was hills and all around fields, and this was very important because Mussolini and the architect Gino Peressutti, the Italian architect, thought that it was very important in order to shoot the outdoor scene. For example, Gino Peressutti, before presenting the project to the state, visited the other studios in England, in Berlin, in Nice, especially in England and in Berlin. He could understand that with that weather was quite difficult to shoot the outdoor scene. So they could profit by the mild weather of the center of Italy, exactly in this area. So the architect project conceived a sort of cinema, a properly city for the cinema. Berlin, Nice, London, they used the building with that originally were conceived for other purposes, so they were readaptation. This was the very first city. The model was, of course, Hollywood. And they and also succeeded in doing something similar. So the project included five studios gradually built over the time. Today we have 20 studios, 19 because the 17th for bad luck was never built. But as you can see, Cinecittà opened in 60 hectares and today we have 40, but the studios are more in numbers. And the architect also conceived the project thinking about all the necessity. He set the studios side by side in order to encourage the fast movement of the devices, for example, or of the backdrop actors. For example, just to give you some numbers, for Ben-Hur in 1959, they used 60,000 of backdrop actors. So it was a large amount of people. It was important to think how to manage all these people, to gather them in a unique place, in one place, and also to think that there were many productions at the same time. So this was very important.
No! I warn you, Rome is an affront to God. Rome is strangling my people and my country, the whole earth. But not forever. I tell you, the day Rome falls, there will be a shout of freedom such as the world has never heard before.
The style of the architecture style of Cinecittà is an example of industrial rationalism. Today, Cinecittà belongs, the soil belongs to the state, because it's a quite important example of industrial rationalism, but it's run by private since 1997. So you can recognize, because there are many examples also in Europe of the rationalism, the strictness of the lines, but there is also a particularity that is the round windows, the oblong, that break this strictness and also characterize the industrial rationalism. During the Second World War, they were not shooting. Nazis first and Americans later occupied Cinecittà. It became a prison camp and then a refugee camp. Many people used to live there, here, especially in the studio number 5 that we are going to visit later. The studio number 5 became a real shelter for many people. Some children were born there and the last people left in 1955. They were among Italians, Libyans, also Roman. You have to remember that Rome was bombarded in 1943. So many people left, remained without their home. After the Second World War, and this is going to be explained in the exhibition, starts the American colossal season. So many movies like the one that we quoted before, Ben-Hur, but also Quo Vadis and Cleopatra in 1963, were very important. They brought job works for many people, from backdrop actors to artisans to actors to whatever.
Why do you stop, Bibitz?
In the corridor, there is movement.
That's how the Romans frighten the enemy, by stamping the elephant feet.
No, this is one man, followed by others. Caesar, I would say.
Would you?
Also, consider that Rome, that was going out in the 50s after the Second World War, was facing one of the most important cultural period. It was a cultural melting pot. If there were exhibitions by Mondrian, Picasso, also at Galleria Nazionale d'Arte Moderna in Rome, it was very, you can understand that was not only the cinema, but many other fermenti, other, I don't know how to say the fermenti, but anyway, it was a vivid moment for the city, and also the neorealism that started immediately after the Second World War. The very first movie was in 1945, Roma Città Aperta by Rossellini, that was shot in the ruins of a bombarded city and going out from the war.
Well, we'll continue our tour of Italy's famous Cinecittà film studios later in the show. For now though, let's meet one of the country's most celebrated filmmakers working today. If Ben-Hur and Cleopatra gave us a glimpse of a city long lost, The Great Beauty sets out to explain this crumbling mammoth as it exists in modern Italy. We sat down with its renowned director Paolo Sorrentino to discuss what else but films and food.
I made a dinner at Red River in New Mexico, a place where we were shooting this film. I had a lovely house there that I shared with two members of the crew. We had a huge mountain cottage, all in wood, and we invited for dinner this actor, for us mythical, who is called Henry Dean Stanton, who walked with us for a day. In This Must Be the Place, he is the inventor of the suitcase, with whom Sean Penn has a long dialogue. He is an actor. We were all very excited because for us, he is a mythological actor. He is the main character of a great film of Wim Wenders, Paris, Texas. At the time, he was 45, and he played the main character. He is an extraordinary actor. He did westerns. For us who love cinema, he was a sort of god. And it was very beautiful because we organized a wonderful Italian dinner, but we had no idea. Despite being over 80 years old, he smokes almost 5 packs a day. He is thin as a rake. He doesn't eat. So we ate our Italian food, and he didn't even touch the food. But when I work on a set, sets are very tiring and you eat a lot. Everyone eats a lot. You work a lot. It depends a lot on where you are. When I shot the film with Sean Penn in America, we were in godforsaken places, dimenticati da Dio. There was nothing. We ate terribly. There were places where you could only eat badly. In the American interiors, you ended up eating Mexican. When I came back, my wife was shocked when she saw me coming in through the door. I had been away for months. I was monstrous. I was almost 100 kilos. I had become really fat. Thankfully, I lost them because I was really uncomfortable. I couldn't move well. I wasn't too fat, but I felt big. I'm very banally Italian a person, but not at all as a director. Being 45 years old, I belong to the first generation that are quite emancipated from localism. The current generation much more so, but also us to some degree. We grew up with music that was not Italian. We grew up with a cinema that was not Italian. The cultural references of my generation are not Italian. They are also Italian, but not like they used to be for the generations previous to mine. So the work I do, but also the work of many of my colleagues, are works that stumble into Italy but are not necessarily Italian. Sometimes they are European. There are things that have to do with Europe. But my lifestyle is completely Italian. It depends a lot on the film. The Great Beauty is a profoundly Italian film rooted in Italy. This Must Be the Place is a film I have at heart, and it is rooted in certain music videos that are not Italian, in a vast series of cultural references that are not Italian. It's a film in which I put everything of non-Italian that had ever influenced me. Paris, Texas is a film that I watched. The things that in the end influence you the most are not the most beautiful. They are the ones that happen in important moments of your life. Paris, Texas is a film that I watched as a teenager. My brother introduced me to it, my older brother. As his little brother, I deeply admired him. My older brother, who knew things I couldn't even know what they were from. Perhaps Paris, Texas is not even the most beautiful film I have ever watched, but it's one of the films that came in a moment of my life that was fundamental. At that age, you are still very innocent, so you receive things in an amplified way. Youth is a film that some love. Some, a small group, love it. It is liked, it is really loved. But a part of the audience hates it. Youth wanted to be a simple film, but I realized that I am not good at doing simple things well. So it's better if I stick to other things. It's an extremely simple film. It's so simple that it's almost banal. It is very simple. Two old men experience pains, joys, memories and inconveniences of age.
Con ricordi, gioie, dolori e acciacchi dell'età.
Italy's master of the cinema, Paolo Sorrentino. We'll continue wandering Cinecittà soon, but up next, an Australian film hits cinemas here in the UK today, but it also shares a rather special relationship with Italy. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is Rudolph Valentino, the legendary Hollywood movie actor, and I'd like to tell you about an amazing program here on Monocle 24, the cinema show.
When you are at the Oscars, I've been at the ceremony once, it's a very, very different feeling than you get in New York or London or wherever else around the globe, because this is an industry town and this is its night.
Each week, the cinema show meets some of the most fascinating personalities from the world of movies. In fact, if I weren't strictly a star of silent movies, I might even appear on the show myself. The cinema show, in association with movie, because life is too short for bad films, and I should know.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. The Australian film Holding the Man shines a light on gay life in the city of Melbourne during the 1970s and 80s. It is, of course, a long way from Italy. Yet the opening scene of the beautifully shot drama takes us to the Italian island of Lipari. Holding the Man is adapted from the memoir of actor Timothy Conigrave. Its release back in 1995 caused quite the stir, not only due to Australia's somewhat unusual stance on homosexuality, but also because of the deeply affecting love story that underpins its narrative. While attending a prestigious Catholic school as a teenager, Conigrave became involved with the gruff football player John Calio. The couple were rarely apart for the next 15 years, during which they struggled against prejudice, family disapproval, and the AIDS epidemic. The screen adaptation probably couldn't have come at a more important time. With an election due soon, Australia is currently in the midst of a heated debate about the legalisation of same-sex marriage, and the movie has naturally become part of that discourse. Monocle's Melbourne correspondent Adrian Craddock sat down with actor Craig Stott, who plays Conigrave's longtime partner John Calio. They began by discussing how his involvement in the project came about.
I just got an audition for it in November 2013 and was just immediately sort of besotted with the idea of a gay love story coming out of Australia, which is not, it's still essentially a taboo subject here, you know. You know, I've walked down the street holding my boyfriend's hand here and you still get looks, and so it's not, I mean, it's not something that's totally been accepted into the society, and it's not something that's been normalised in other parts of the world, say like in Holland or now in America. So I knew a gay love story coming out of Australia was very out of the ordinary.
What is it about the story, you know, both in book form and now in the film, that has such a cut through? I mean, why do you think people resonate with it so much?
Because it's love. I mean, everyone relates to love. I hope everyone relates to love. I mean, the fact that it's gay is a hugely important part of it. But I think underneath that, I mean, my sisters who've seen it, who are all heterosexual, all ended up in tears. And I mean, I've heard countless stories where that's been the case. You know, love is a universal theme. It's something that we can all relate to as a species, and I think something that we all yearn to have as a species. So to see it presented on the screen and to see a love surviving such absolute unjust bullshit is very special to a lot of people. It's a fight for love.
The book is based on the lives of two real people. Was there any kind of feeling of pressure or responsibility to get their story right, or did you just kind of have to, you know, interpret the character your own way?
I understood after the fact just how important the book was to so many people, especially when the film got released, but I never felt like I had to live up to these people's expectations of the book. It was purely just me doing my job, which was to get as much information as I possibly could, get as many facts as I could about this guy, and try and inhabit him as best I could. It's been so wonderful and so fortunate that people have responded and said, oh, that's exactly how I thought John was, or that is exactly how John was, from people who knew him. But no, I never felt that pressure. I think you can't feel that pressure because it hinders the performance. You just have to do your job, really.
When the film was initially released in Australia, it came out at a very apt time. It was right in the middle of kind of a big national debate about how we were going to approach this issue of gay marriage. How was that for you, you know, seeing this debate erupt around the same time as the movie coming out?
It really pissed me off. We started our press junket right on the day after Abbott decided to disallow a conscience vote. Which essentially meant that they would have to vote in line with the party the Liberal Party's incredibly homophobic policy towards LGBTIQ people in this country. And I felt a deep, deep anger. I mean, the thing is, it's all about fear. And I feel as though with every generation, it's getting a little bit less. The thing is, society is evolving at such a rapid pace that there are some people, conservatives, that just cannot handle it, you know.
Since the film was released in Australia, we now have a new Prime Minister. Are you any more optimistic about how this issue will be tackled with Malcolm Turnbull?
Turnbull is basically serving up the same shit that Abbott did, but he's doing it with much more eloquence. The fact of the matter is, a plebiscite's extremely expensive, and he's putting it to that because they're hoping this issue will just go away. You know, they're hoping that gay rights was something of last year, you know, but this is an ongoing struggle. And we're in it for the long run.
Do you see a film like Holding the Man as an activist film in some sort, or is it dangerous to kind of give it that kind of title?
I mean, I think the idea of being gay or being LGBTIQ is innately political. I mean, you walk down the street holding a boy's hand, you're going to cop looks, as I have. So, I mean, look, you look at it as a political film. Look, at the end of the day, it's a story of love. But the fact that it's gay love means that it is innately political.
Australian actor Craig Stodd, Holding the Man, is out in UK cinemas today and available for home viewing in Australia and some other regions too. This is a special edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from the magnificent home of Italian cinema, Rome's Cinecittà. And of course, this show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And if you're interested in a whole month of movies for free, head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. We'll continue our tour of Cinecittà now. As we've learned, many of Europe's greatest filmmakers based themselves here. And while Fellini did indeed shoot that iconic scene in the fountain from La Dolce Vita, in the actual fountain, he also made great use of Studio 5, as we're about to hear with our tour guide, Elena Scipioni.
So this is the studio number 5, we said before, that hosted many people during the Second World War, but is related to the memory of Federico Fellini. There is a golden plaque on the wall celebrating his important director, international director. Federico Fellini used to sleep inside the studio. When the people asked him, which is your favorite city in Italy, he said Cinecittà. There were two places he used to love, the studio number 5 and Eur, the neighborhood in Rome that was built by Mussolini, EUR, for the Expo, the Universal Expo, and it's in the rationalism style, but much more propaganda style. He used to love them because they transmitted a sort of void, metaphysical sensation that contrasted with his movies that were a little bit baroque or very rich movie. In 1960, he shot La Dolce Vita. The reconstruction of the street of Via Veneto was made inside, while the most famous scene of with Anita Ekberg and Marcello Mastroianni was really shot inside the fountain, which is quite a rare occasion when it was given the permission, was allowed to shoot inside a public monument like the fountain. But from a scenographical point of view, it's very important, Casanova, that we saw the head of the Venusian before, because Casanova was located among Dresda, Paris, Venice, with Casanova that is rowing on a boat, and you can perceive that the sea is a black fabric. It was in his aesthetic to like to understand the tricks, to play with the artifacts, to play with the potentiality of cinema. Or you can see Casanova under the snow, the rain, or in very rich indoor scenes. 2 hours and 20 minutes of movie that you can find also on the web in Italian were entirely reconstructed inside the studio, which is the biggest in Europe with 3,000 meters square of space. And the head of the Venusian that was opening the movie, emerging from the Canal Grande of Venice during the nightlife celebration of Carnival, was emerging from the two trapdoors inside the studio.
The Forum Music Village is often considered the Abbey Road of Italy. Such is the cultural importance of the recording facility. But among the long list of names who continue flocking to this treasured spot in the heart of Rome, there's perhaps one name who sticks out, and indeed, it was he who started it all. Standing in the middle of the main performance space, I spoke to the Forum's studio manager Marco Patrignani.
Oh, first of all, Ennio Morricone. We are honored that Maestro Morricone founded this place in the late of 60s, in 1969 exactly. And so after that, he recorded in this place all his masterpieces, including Once Upon a Time in America and La Leggenda del Pianista sull'Oceano. I don't know the English title, sorry, and Nuovo Cinema Paradiso. So actually Ennio Morricone is one of the biggest name, together with Nicola Piovani, also Oscar Prize for Life is Beautiful, were recorded here.
What do you think it is about this particular place that has drawn so many people like that over the years?
I suppose, first of all, the reason is that Ennio Morricone, together with three other very important film music composer, as Armando Trovajoli, Luis Bacalov and Piero Piccioni, were founding together with Morricone this place in the late 60s. So this is a very big complex, as you can see, is over 1,000 square meters. And so it's actually the only place in Italy where you can record up to 100 musicians together.
Now, just going back to that long list of names of people who have worked here, I don't want to get too romantic about it, but it does sort of strike me that maybe for people who come to work here today, they might look at some of the people who have worked here before and somehow just knowing that those sorts of creations have been born in these four walls, that might actually help their own creative process. Do you think that the fact that this place has become such a beacon for so many people who are so accomplished, that sort of makes the place sort of maybe take on a life of its own?
Yeah, exactly. From what I learned during my experience with many interesting and great artists from all over the world, for example, like I remember Quincy Jones, that obviously all of us know and knows and respects. And I have to say that I learned from them that they are very inspired from this place. It's like they say they can still feel the energy of Federico Fellini, who was working here, or Vittorio Gassman, the legend of the Italian cinema. And so even when we work with new artists, modern artists, or electronic music, they say they can keep a kind of very important vibe and energy in this place. That's why maybe it's like the music that was made here is still in this room when we are talking now, me and you, today. You know, it's like it's still there and it's amazing.
Marco Patrignani from Rome's Forum Music Village. And that's it for this special edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from the amazing Cinecittà Film Studios in Rome. Next week, we'll head to Naples with Italian writer Roberto Saviano, the man behind the ground-shattering mafia film Gomorra. And we'll look at the stunning Villa Malaparte on the Isle of Capri, which you might remember from Jean-Luc Godard's 1963 film Le Mépris. Today's program was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yolene Goffin and Mari Giusti. And special thanks to our guide here at Cinecittà, Elena Scipioni. Tours here are open to the public. Check online for details. Catch up on past episodes of this show over at monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe so you're always up to date. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.